My name is Molly Sauter. I'm a graduate student in the Comparative Media Studies at MIT, and I'm a research assistant at the Center for Civic Media at the Media Lab. And the presentation you have wandered into is Hackers as Media Metaphor, Policy Effects of Media Portrayals of Hackers and Hacktivists. So before I start this talk, first, this talk is going to focus on, media coverage and law from an American perspective. So if you're bringing an international perspective to the audience, that's awesome, and I'd love to talk about it in the Q&A, but you're not going to find any of it here, with minor exceptions. First major caveat, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a law student, I'm going to be talking about law in this talk. Please don't go out and do anything based on what I'm telling you in this talk. I don't want to be held responsible for that. The second caveat I have is I am not a hacker. I don't consider myself to be part of the hacking subculture. I just spend a lot of time studying it and talking to them. So please don't tweet that I said that I was a hacker or a member of Anonymous. This brings up the interesting question of what types of hackers am I talking about? The hacker that I'm going to be talking about is not a security researcher. He's not a DIY or maker person, they're not programmers, or any of the millions of identities and disciplines that could conceivably be lumped into the hacking social, sociocultural group. What I'm going to be talking about is this guy. The media metaphor of a hacker, and what I mean by a media metaphor is he's a type of cognitive shorthand that removes the necessity to further explore ideas of what computer crime is, or even who we're talking about, or the underlying structures that we're discussing. So instead, we say, oh, hacker, I know what that is. It's this guy. So this character really started in the 1980s, moved through science fiction into popular culture in movies like War Games, Sneakers, Hackers, and now really shows up on an almost nightly basis in our news feeds. And he's a manifestation of our fear and the discourse of danger and fear that surrounds the internet, has really surrounded the internet for about 30 years now. And the result has been a legal regime that, in the quest of capturing this guy, really brings a lot of activities that we as computer users would engage in normally. It brings a lot of things under suspicion and threatens to really trample our rights in terms of free speech as well as in terms of technology. And by looking at depictions of hackers in fiction news coverage, I'm going to look at the rhetorical framing strategies that surround these ideas and then look at the legal effects of this, both in terms of actual laws that have been passed and sort of general judicial practices that go along with that. So in the beginning, there was cyberpunk. Familiar with cyberpunk? So cyberpunk was a genre that started in the 80s. The big names, William Gibson, Neal Stephenson. You have what is really the proto-hacker character showing up in books like Burning Chrome, Neuromancer, and Snow Crash. And as Lawrence Pearson wrote in his really great essay, Notes Towards Cyberpunk Manifesto, which I recommend if you're interested in this, is classic cyberpunk characters were marginalized, alienated loners who lived on the edge of society in generally dystopic futures where daily life was impacted by rapid technological change and a ubiquitous data sphere. This character was embraced by hacker culture in the 1980s. Books like Neuromancer and Snow Crash, as well as movies like The Matrix, as well as other novels like Mona Lisa, Overdrive, were very, very popular in the subculture at the time. And they embraced this character as a hero in their own culture. This also then migrated into more mainstream popular culture and became the blueprint for hacker characters in other movies. Now, the next couple slides are more or less in sort of chronological order, but not really. So first we have characters like the Matthew Broderick character in War Games, and he's really the first modern hacker character to show up in movies. How many people have seen War Games? Okay, so War Games is a movie where you have a Matthew Broderick character who has a computer in his bedroom. He's got one of those modems where you pick up the phone and you put it on the modem and it talks to the computer that way. He's depicted as knowing a lot about computers, having a lot of power over computers, but all he really wants to do is play video games. That's how he gets into trouble. He tries to dial up a video game company and pirate their not-yet-released video game so he can play it and impress his girlfriend. But accidentally, he dials NORAD because, hey, you can do that then. And starts interacting with a computer who starts a war simulation who almost starts World War III. So in this archetype, you have someone who is incredibly technologically sophisticated, but is emotionally immature, legally immature, doesn't understand what he's doing, and is motivated by selfish and immature reasons. He wants to play a game and he wants to impress a girl. This character then later evolves into the reformed criminal character, which appears in Hackers, Swordfish, which I do not recommend, and Sneakers, which I do recommend. The reformed criminal character has been arrested in the past. So in Hackers, the character is arrested when he's very young. In Swordfish, the Hugh Jackman character is just released from prison. And in Sneakers, basically the entire team is ex-cons. And they're trying to go straight. They're really trying. It's a lot like in The Godfather when he's like, every time I get out, they pull me back in. And the hacker is forced to re-engage in his criminal activities because of issues of money, issues of revenge, issues of personal redemption. So in Hackers, we have Angelina Jolie and the Zero Cool / Crash Override character engaged in a competition / courtship. In Swordfish is actually a really interesting example because Swordfish is the only movie I found where the hacker has a family. Hackers are generally not portrayed as being mature enough to have a family. So Hugh Jackman's main motivation in this movie is getting his daughter back, but for that he has to re-engage in criminal hacking. And in Sneakers, the team is tricked into stealing something from someone they shouldn't have stolen it from, and then they have to steal it back. This character then evolves into the sociopathic villain character. How many people have seen Live Free or Die Hard? He throws a helicopter into a car, or a car into a helicopter. It's awesome. The sociopathic villain character is a character who uses his superior skill for either destructive fun or personal gain, usually with the results of bringing down the system. What is interesting about Live Free or Die Hard is that it illustrates what's called a SCADA attack. A SCADA attack is an attack against the supervisory control and data acquisition systems of either a company or a nation state. What they're basically the backbone of the electric grid, the water system, anything that is really big and really important, a SCADA system runs it. And basic fears of techno-apocalypses are based around SCADA system hack ideas. So there's a really great example of a SCADA attack in this movie. We move from the sociopathic villain character to the juvenile team member character. You'll find this in heist movies. You'll find this in movies like GoldenEye. The juvenile team member is a member of a larger team, but he doesn't share the same motivations of that team. His goal is generally not the motivations of the team at large. Specifically in The Italian Job, which is a remake of a previous version of The Italian Job, the Seth Green character is the computer hacker character. He likes to sit in airports with his Dell and laugh at people. But his main goal in all of this is not the revenge goal that the larger team has. It's not money. It's not profit. He wants the world to know that he really created Napster. He says that his roommate stole the idea while he was napping, and that's why it's called Napster, and he just wants to be on the cover of Wired and show the world that he really made it up. So his motivation is extremely selfish. It has nothing to do with what anyone else is doing. And they're also generally depicted as being incredibly disloyal, as with the Alan Cummings character in GoldenEye, jumps from team to team throughout the movie and does not display loyalty to anyone and then dies in a really cool way. So they're motivated by selfish desires like previous incarnations of the hacker character, and they can't be trusted. So taking all of these archetypes together, we can see the image of the hacker character as displayed in popular film. They are almost always white, with some notable exceptions. They are almost always male. They are immature, they are socially awkward, they are alienated and vindictive, and generally motivated by selfish goals or deep-seated personality problems, usually from a troubled childhood or this previously mentioned social awkwardness. The plot lines of these movies are incredibly tinged with techno-paranoia. There's a deep-rooted fear of technology in these movies. And these fears are apocalyptic. it's reflected in the SCADA system hack that it all could go down at any moment because the hackers are going to get in and take down the tubes. And this is because the hackers have supreme control over computers and the networks that control the world. Also prevalent is the insider threat plot line. You can see this in movies like Jurassic Park and Antitrust, where you have the same techno-paranoia, except on a global scale, you have it on a corporate scale. But basically, the takeaway I want you to get from this is these movies reflect power binaries. You have the opposition of people who are technologically powerful, namely the hacker, and the technologically powerless, who is the audience or us, that we are set in opposition to each other. So we see a lot of these things also in news coverage of computer crimes. We can see a lot of the same imagery and a lot of the same storylines being played out in how computer crime is covered by the news. As I mentioned before, you have a hacker character who is immature, socially awkward, not upwardly mobile. And just as an example, here are some news articles I found that talk about hackers in basements. Hackers love basements. So the teenager hacker holed up in his parents' basement from the New York Times. A kid in his basement can write a malicious app from the Daily Beast. In an article about the Sasser worm, which was a very destructive computer virus worm that got out a couple years ago, made by an 18-year-old school student working from his basement. Or my favorite, some super empowered cyber vandal probably working on a PC out of a basement somewhere. All the hackers I know use Macs. I don't know why they're focused on PCs. But you can see the image that is called up. You say hacker in a basement, you can immediately visualize that. It's an extremely powerful visual metaphor, but it's also extremely limiting. The other aspect that comes out of news coverage is that all of these guys are super users. Super user is a term coined by Paul Ohm in a really great paper called The Myth of the Super User, which I highly recommend. The super user can use technology in ways that other people cannot even fathom, cannot even begin to fathom. It's like, holy shit, that's a lot of monitors. I don't even know how he's looking at all of those. This is from Swordfish. Not recommend it. Don't watch it. The super user uses computers in ways that are impossible to understand and thus are impossible to defend against. All of this leads to an environment where the hacker is easily labeled as the villain in any computer-related piece that is currently in play, even if it's not true. As is the case with most news coverage, a correction or an addition to a news story never travels as far as the original news story, and in some cases may not even be made at all. And in any case, the original report has added to the hacker myth in ways that can never be taken back. So I'm now going to go into a couple examples of wildly misreported news coverage and sort of the fallout or lack of fallout that happened. How many people have... Oh, sorry. I'm going to not do that right now. These are some of the basic aspects of computer crime coverage. Any crime that involves a computer is generally blamed on hackers. Anyone who was near a computer when they committed a crime is called a hacker. If you sneezed on a Dell and then robbed a store, you may be called a computer hacker. One really great example of this was the Sarah Palin email hack. How many people remember when that happened? So the funny thing about the Sarah Palin email hack was the way the guy did it was he went to Sarah Palin's Yahoo account and clicked on the I forgot my password button, which then gives you security questions where it asks you things that only you would know. I think it asked him where she met her husband and what street she grew up on. When you're Sarah Palin, those things can be easily found on Wikipedia, which is where he found them. And so he typed those in, reset her password, and that was how he got access to her account. This does not coincide with the super user myth that we just saw. Anyone could do that. I could do that. I wouldn't do that, but I could do that. But it's still being considered a hacking attack because that is ever so much more scarier. Secondly, in coverage of these stories, we have a very strong language of victimization. We're used to hearing about victims of identity theft, victims of hacking, and there is even a very strong rape metaphor in how we talk about computer crimes in general. We call it penetration. And that puts us in a position where we are very eager to take sides, and it's very easy for us to pick which side we want to be on. Coverage confuses what could happen with what is actually happening. This is actually my favorite headline that I found during the whole course of my research. Black hat hacker can remotely attack insulin pumps and kill people. This is a story about a report that was given during a DEF CON conference, I believe, though it might have been Black Hat, where a researcher came forward and said, I have done research on the insulin pump that I wear all the time, and I discovered that there is a way that you can disrupt the radio communication process and get it to discharge any amount of insulin you want. However, this was a theoretical attack. It had never been done. It had never even been successfully done by him. Basically, what he was saying is, I have found a theoretical weakness in this device, and I would like to tell you all about it because it's a security conference. This is taken by CBS News and turned into, the hackers are going to come and kill your diabetic grandfather. Similarly, vague language is used, like often, frequently, and usually, which actually don't really mean a whole lot, especially when you're talking about the frequency of these attacks. But they do sound like a lot of stuff is happening, so it creates a level of fear that is actually based on nothing really whatsoever. Dramatic visual hypotheticals are used, things like power plants failing, nuclear plants exploding, oil pipelines stopping functioning, planes falling out of the sky, children being exploited. These are extremely easy to visualize and extremely tempting to immediately react to. You say, yes, that's bad. Obviously, then, hackers are bad. But it creates more of a sense of danger and creates more of a sense of reaction than actually conveying useful information. Really powerful ideographic slogans are used repeatedly. This one comes from the Defense Department. We are apparently all waiting for a digital Pearl Harbor. Now, I would like everyone to take a couple minutes and think about what a digital Pearl Harbor would actually be. We're going to get attacked by the Japanese. We're going to get bombed. We are going to get dragged into a war we don't really want to get involved in. Lots of people are going to die. Okay, step back. No one has actually ever died from a cyber attack. No one has died as a result of a hacking attack, ever. It hasn't happened. But words like digital Pearl Harbor make it really easy to visualize in the abstract that happening. Now I'm going to get to Kevin Mitnick. Raise your hand if you've heard of Kevin Mitnick. Okay, Kevin Mitnick was the most wanted hacker ever. He was actually more of a phone freaker and a social engineer, but he really pissed off the FBI and a couple of other people and was sort of pushed to the forefront of being the most wanted hacker in the 90s. So in 1994, John Markoff, who was a writer for the New York Times, wrote this article in which he stated that as a teenager, Kevin Mitnick used a computer and a modem to break into the North American Air Defense Command computer, foreshadowing war games, incidentally, and did some stuff. This story was later repeated by the St. Louis Dispatch, the Los Angeles Times, the St. Petersburg Times, and CNN, among other sources. The CNN one is really interesting, and I'm going to get to that in a second. Because there's actually no evidence that Kevin Mitnick ever did this. This was actually highly disputed by three of Mitnick's four biographers. The fourth one was Markoff himself, and he actually dropped the claim in his subsequent biography. These were all disputed in 1996, which was when Mitnick was imminently arrested and a bunch of these biographies came out. The CNN report was in 1999. So 3 years after substantial intellectual work had been done disproving this claim, we still have reputable news sources repeating it as if it is true. Because it's just so damn sexy to say that he hacked into NORAD and that inspired war games. It makes such a cute little package of hackery, but it's still not true. How many people remember the Brazilian blackout story? It was in 2009. Basically, there were huge blackouts in Brazil, and everyone was like, holy shit, it must be hackers. It must be a SCADA attack that we've been hearing so much about. This was initially reported by 60 Minutes and was repeated by Wired and a couple of other news sources. A couple of days after that, we discovered it wasn't actually hackers, it was sooty insulators. Wired published a correction to the story. 60 Minutes still maintains that it was hackers because of six unnamed sources in the Defense Department for their unwilling to name. So we have this echo chamber of defense industry talk up against other echo chambers of talk, but CNN refuses to publish even a, this may be disputed. It may be soot. Nope, it was definitely hackers. Finally, how many people remember the Illinois water utility incident? So there was a water utility in Illinois, and suddenly this pump in it started going off and on and off and on and off and on, and then it burned out, and it was holy shit. It was the hackers. They got into the system, and they turned the pump off and on and on and on and off, and then it burned out, and it died. And obviously, this is an American version of Stuxnet. This is the American SCADA attack that we have all been dreading. It's here now. Brave new world. Holy shit. This was reported by the Christian Science Monitor, Wired, the Washington Post. Basically, everyone picked this up because it was a really sexy story. It was actually a contractor remoting in from vacation in Russia because someone asked him a question. And the water pump burned out because sometimes water pumps burn out. But it was really fun to correlate those two events and say, OMGs, to hackers, in the water tubes, we're all going to die. So that's the news coverage side of all of this. If we take the fictional movie coverage and the actual news coverage, what can we get from the rhetorical framing strategies that we're seeing? This guy is no longer just a character. This guy is no longer just a go-to character like the kooky next-door neighbor that you can plug into a screenplay. This guy has evolved into what's known as a folk devil. A folk devil is a character who is seen as a society at large as dangerous or deviant and is blamed for society's problems. The folk devil exists to help society delineate good behavior from bad behavior and acceptable norms from unacceptable norms of behavior. What the folk devil does is he personifies our anxieties about technology, technologically mediated societies, and our increasingly technologically mediated selves. And there are a couple salient characteristics of the hacker as folk devil that I want to go over. One, he's too immature to abide by conventional morality. He doesn't believe that the rules apply to him. He's socially alienated, so he lacks the standard social checks and balances on his behavior that the rest of us enjoy. He is pathological in his behavior. He cannot help himself. And in fact, we can see this popping up in modern news coverage, where you have things like the Asperger's defense, which is something that is popping up in the Gary McKinnon case, where he's fighting extradition to the U.S. on hacking charges. We can also see this explicitly addressed in War Games, where one of the hackers, where one of the characters is sent by his lawyer to an AA meeting because he's addicted to the internet and that's why he hacks so much. Three, he is a super user. He has great powers over computers and the network, and because he is locationless and decentralized, he is a threat anywhere you are. If I'm in a room with a scary guy, and I don't like him and I want to be away from him, I can just leave the room. But as long as I'm connected to the network, or as long as I have things that I care about that are connected to the network, I am always at risk from hacking attacks. Therefore, he is ever so much scarier due to the locationless nature of the character. So to sum it up, he's abnormal, he's alienated from conventional morals, he is a predictable bad actor because he's pathological and compulsive in his behavior, and he's willing and capable of causing great harm to civilians. This is not only applies to the hacker character himself, but it also applies to anyone who really engages in activities that could ever be associated with the hacker character. You don't have to be a white teenager in his parents' basement to be held suspicious if you engage in activities that are associated with the hacker character. This is a central part of what's known as a discourse of danger. A discourse of danger is a state-level discourse that creates a sense of insecurity based on real and imagined threats both from within and without the state, and is used to shape the identity of the individuals within that state by othering an enemy. You find an enemy, you say, that's the enemy. People who are different than that are us. We are different from that. They are different from us. And the hacker character is a central part of the discourse of danger that is surrounding the internet. He's also a central part of the culture of fear. What a culture of fear is an exaggerated public expectation of crime and danger, which is felt regardless of whether or not that danger actually exists. It's also exacerbated by a perceived gap between reported threat and response. I see a lot of reports about hacking on the news, but I don't see a lot of people getting arrested for hacking. Therefore, I think, oh God, all Tay hackers are out there somewhere because I keep hearing about them, but I never see them get arrested. So the films and the narrative present in the news coverage exacerbate, confirm, and add to an already existing discourse of danger and culture of fear surrounding the internet. These are just a couple examples of the pervasiveness of that culture of fear. So in 2006, the UK government did a study that found that fear of internet crime is now more prevalent than concerns about more conventional crimes, such as burglary, mugging, and car theft in the UK. In 2003, the Pew Internet and American Life Project found that 49% of Americans fear that terrorists will cripple American utilities with SCADA system attacks through the internet. And in 2001, 2 years previous, the same project found that over 70% of Americans were concerned or very concerned about child pornography, credit card theft, hackers, and terrorism online. We can also see aspects of the discourse being specifically referenced both in pop culture and in news media. So we believe that technology is becoming uncontrollable or incomprehensible to normal people, which is essentially the main plot line of War Games. We create this awesome computer called the Whopper, which is going to protect us from nuclear war, but we don't understand it, and it runs away from us and almost kills us all. Second, technological complexity hides fatal weaknesses in the system. This is central to fear of SCADA-level attacks. You can see, actually, that first headline also refers to the crazy-ass insulin hack headline that I talked about before. Your phone is a military threat. Oh God, I'm scared, because DARPA told me so. And again, more instances of SCADA-level attacks popping up in the news. We feel threatened by technology and by technological threats on a personal, corporate, and state level. So did everyone see the net? It's okay. It's not as bad as some. Basically, Sandra Bullock loses her entire life because she's getting chased by a hacker and has to get it all back at the end. And finally, the state cannot protect us from this threat. We don't believe that the state is actually capable of mustering itself on the cyber field of battle and protecting us from these threats. My favorite headline is, FBI hacked while Congress ponders cybersecurity legislation. Oh God, they can't even protect themselves. So that's the rhetorical framing around this issue that's drawn from the movies that we looked at and the news coverage that we looked at. So what is the legal effect of all this? How does all this play out on the legal and policy level? What you have to understand is that hackers are both the target of computer crime legislation and they're also the justification for the distribution of privileges and rights both within the Department of Justice and other investigatory bodies, but they're also the justification for the laws themselves that are passed. We're not the target of computer crime legislation. These guys are. We're fighting the giant shadowy keyboard hand of death with things like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. We're not actually seeking to regulate normal people. However, it's normal people, who are eventually caught up in this because the mythical hacker character doesn't actually exist. So now I'm going to be looking at something called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is the central piece of computer crime legislation. It was initially passed in the mid-90s and has been amended something like 6 times since then. It's basically the world's biggest game of legal catch-up. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is extremely broad. It uses extremely broad language to affect the ends that it wants to achieve. And one of the ways it does that is that it targets what's known as conduct elements of a crime rather than focusing on, say, the result, harm, intent, or attendant circumstance elements that are also part of a sort of the whole buildup of a crime. One example of this is Section 1030A5A1, which prohibits causing the transmission of a program, information, code, or command, and causing subsequent damage. This basically means anything you send over a wire could fall under this statute. One example of this is the case of Brett McDaniel, who worked for a company that dealt with email, they sold email services, and he found a huge bug in their system. And he thought the customers might be interested in knowing that there was a huge security bug in their email system. So he told his company, and the company said, "We don't care." He quit and sent an email to the entire customer list telling them that there was a giant security bug in their email system. And he was arrested and prosecuted under the CFAA for sending those emails because the Department of Justice decided that the sending of the email what counted as information and the damage inflicted on the company's reputation was sufficient enough to adhere to that part of the CFAA. He spent 16 months in jail before they decided maybe that wasn't the best interpretation of the law and withdrew their prosecution, and he was released on appeal. He still spent 16 months in jail for sending a bunch of emails, though. Another problem with the CFAA is that it's extremely vague. The wording is ill-defined and could really apply to anything. There is a subsequent section of the CFAA which prohibits accessing a protected computer without authorization. Interesting fact, a protected computer is any computer which engages primarily in the operations of government or interstate commerce, which incidentally is why all the anonymous prosecutions are based around the PayPal hack, the PayPal DDoS attack, because that is a computer that deals with financial transactions across state lines. Interesting fact. So accessing is not defined. Without authorization is not defined. And this becomes relevant in a civil suit in 2001 called EF Cultura Travel BV versus Explorica. The CFAA permits civil lawsuits that adhere to the things prohibited in the CFAA. Not all laws do that. They allege that Explorica accessed in order to defraud EF Cultural Travel, but what the access was scraping of publicly available pricing information from a website and using it in an internal document. This is similar to the more recent Aaron Swartz case, where the access in question was using what I believe was a JavaScript tool. Was it a JavaScript tool? Yeah. To automatically download something like several thousand academic articles from JSTOR, interpreted as access without authorization. Moving on to more generic judicial practices, this law permits incredibly invasive search and seizure practices on the sort of everyday operations of the legal system level. The way it does this is that the broad conduct elements inherent in the law make it extremely easy to make justifiable cause and probable cause for searches and surveillance. I don't need to prove that you meant to commit a crime, I just need to prove that you took an action. And because most surveillance laws regarding the internet don't require two-party consent, you could be surveilled now and you wouldn't actually know it because no one has to tell you a damn thing. Second, judges often sign sweeping search warrants, authorizing the search of all files in a computer, areas of a hard drive that do not store files, forensic off-site searches, which can take months or even years while people come through your computer, because inherently what they're looking for is the wily data hider who is an expert at stenography and hides things everywhere, and you really wouldn't know. We really just have to crawl through the entire hard drive to find, like, pirated music files. We can't just, like, look in the music folder. No, we have to look in the picture folder. We have to look in things that aren't MP3s because they could change file endings. They could do all this shit. It's hackers do crazy stuff to hide their secrets. But these search warrants are often signed that authorize a huge amount of leeway for cops that are looking through your computer. Finally, how many people are familiar with in plain sight as a judicial doctrine? So say I'm a cop and my friend Laura is the poor person that I'm going to go search. And I knock on her door because she has lots of unpaid parking tickets and I'd really, really like her to pay them. And she has a kilo of cocaine sitting on her kitchen table. She doesn't have a kilo of cocaine sitting on her kitchen table, but say she does. I can then arrest her for the crimes that are inherent in having a kilo of cocaine on your kitchen table because it was in plain sight when I entered the apartment. There is confused case law on this issue, but there have been instances where judges have ruled that the entire contents of your computer counts as in plain sight. I take someone's computer because I'm looking for music files, I find evidence of another crime somewhere else on the computer, because it was in plain sight within the container of the computer, I can charge people with a crime based on that evidence. This case law is confused and hasn't been sufficiently established yet, but the fact that it happened at all is extremely troubling. Finally, we have the problem of guilt by association. This happens when power and skill is confused with evil. People who have skills or are very capable with computers are associated with people who are doing evil with computers because we don't understand how they could do good. And this causes legitimate activities and views to be pathologized as hacker behaviors. This is part of a series of flyers that was distributed by the FBI to various community organizations. This is taken from the people who own cyber cafes flyer. It says, what should I consider suspicious? If I see something suspicious, I want to call the FBI and tell them and be a good citizen. People who are overly concerned about privacy and don't like people looking over their shoulder while they're on the internet are suspicious. Does anyone have one of those like things that you put on your screen that makes it black? Raise your hand. Like, you may be a terrorist. Congratulations. Has anyone ever used an anonymizer or a portal or something like Tor to access sites? Congratulations, you may be a terrorist. If you're really interested in radio frequencies, like say you are a ham radio enthusiast, or you're recording police scanner frequencies during protests because you're really interested in having a record of the things that people say when protests are going on, you may also be a terrorist. If you're really interested in data encryption as a hobby or a profession, you may also be a terrorist. We see activities that are maybe not everyday activities, maybe my mom doesn't do them, but they're certainly not illegal, but they are being pathologized as things that are suspicious by being associated with this archetype. Other things, torrenting or using file lockers. Who lost or know someone who lost legitimate files in the mega upload takedown? Yep. Modding or jailbreaking commercial products. Apple can say that jailbreaking the iPhone is illegal because it feels illegal. It feels like that's a hackery thing. It feels like it's not okay. And so they're able to say things like this because of the association we already have with hackers doing bad things. Anonymous or pseudonymous identities online. This is a really scary quote. This is by Randi Zuckerberg, who's the marketing director of Facebook. And she says, I think anonymity on the internet has to go away. Not like on Facebook, like on the internet. People behave a lot better when they have their real names down. I think people hide behind anonymity and they feel they can say whatever they want behind closed doors. You can just see the immature hacker character bleeding out of that statement. You can see the assumption that when you have anonymity on the internet, you turn into this bile-spewing teenage boy in his mother's basement, causing trouble and making horrible things go wrong. So we're taking the idea that anonymity, or even pseudonymity, is a bad thing because it gets associated with these characters. And finally, the disrupting of passive tracking of digital behavior or physical location is also considered suspicious, is also considered a thing that, why don't you want Google to know where you go all the time? Why are you upset that, hey, there's an RFID tag in here? I'm kind of pissed off about that. I'm upset that no one told me there was an RFID tag broadcasting my name in my badge at all times. So those are the legal effects. Those are legal effects that we can trace from the hacker character through the legal system and say, yes, this is a result of preconceptions that people have about hackers because of how the media portrays them. So what are the conclusions from this? I do not have a solution for this. This is a widespread cultural phenomenon. This is something that happens a lot when we have moral panics and existential panics around technology. People react to it like this. However, one interesting thing about this that maybe didn't apply to things like the telegraph or the steamship or electricity or telephones is the internet is rapidly becoming a centralized location for political speech. This is where people come together to talk about politics, to talk about their rights, to talk about cats. I don't care what they're talking about, but people come together here to express themselves, and especially politically. And in the US, we hold political speech as a very high virtue. This is something that we value to a very high degree. So my fundamental question about all this is, do we want political speech of the kind that assisted in events like the Arab Spring, which is where this photo comes from? Do we want this regulated by a fear of something that doesn't exist? Do we want to use the hacker character as an excuse to regulate political speech? And that's the fundamental question that I want to ask out of all of this. I got lots of awesome help from awesome people, mostly from MIT, but I also want to specifically call out a gentleman by the name of Space Rogue, who really helped me in terms of finding news articles about hackers, and he's awesome. I also got money from the Harvard-MIT ECIR program for this, so they're also really cool. That's my bibliography. If you want to know more, I can send you the really big one, which includes all the news articles and is like 5 pages long. And now it's time for questions. Yeah. Yes, I did.
Yeah.
So, and I decided not to talk to you about this yesterday when I accosted you at the AFF booth. I thought the We Are Legion movie was very one-sided. I thought it was extremely aimed at being very pro-anonymous, which honestly was something I could have anticipated. I could have anticipated that, yeah. I thought it was really cool that they talked to people like Chris Weissopel, who is a former member of The Loft, and members of Attrition, who is an old school hacker organization, as well as academics like Biela Coleman and people like Josh Corman. What I found really interesting about that was, so I don't know if Chris himself was a member of the CDC, but he mentioned the CDC by name. The CDC is a group called the Cult of the Dead Cow, which is one of the original hacktivist organizations from the 90s. They do not like Anonymous. In fact, the main spokesperson for the CDC is a gentleman by the name of Oxblood Ruffian. He's really not quiet about how much he dislikes Anonymous and has been stating since the 90s when the EDT started doing activist DDoS attacks that he believes that DDoS attacks are censorship and should not be considered hacktivism and are a very bad thing. That was not addressed at all, which I found very interesting and slightly disappointing. I also found the way Anonymous participation in the Arab Spring and particularly Occupy Wall Street at the end to also be extremely unnuanced. I would have preferred to have more nuance than that. But that's my opinion of the movie.
It's highly slanted in our
Yeah.
But if you speak to the Q&A after the one day, they asked them that question.
No, I went to the panel today, and I was happy to see that come up. I was happy to see people be like, yes, DDoS is actually very controversial, and people have lots of thoughts about it.
And the big reason that it happens is because you can go to the press with all the proof you want or something back.
Yeah.
And they ignore you.
No, it's definitely true.
You go to the press and DDoS the bad guy, then they'll print the bad thing that you wanted them to print in the first place. It's the only way to get them to listen.
Definitely true. I actually just wrote a paper about this in which I argued that the biggest advancement in activist tactics that is embodied in Anonymous's use of the DDoS is basically press manipulation. And the fact that specifically the fact that they brought up the CDC and they talked to Chris and then didn't talk about that was like, well, why didn't you talk about that?
They did. Yeah, I've seen some of the video about it.
Okay,
the
cool.
The problem was you saw how long the thing was.
Yeah.
He had to cover it.
Yeah, so filmmaking is filmmaking. Yeah.
So I think the issue you bring up here is interesting in that, so you show us a model of how people conceive of hackers, and you also then relate that to legal problems themselves. But the legal issues you bring up are actually really, they're statutory issues.
Yeah.
It's very true that they
Yeah.
Really big problems. And, you know, would they sometimes try to find their identity and have called their parents before?
Mm-hmm.
And things like that. But, you know, it's not really the type of thing where you can actually apply this law in a satisfactory way. You know,
yeah. Something that's part of the larger project but wasn't actually part of this presentation is the effect of the Defense Department and as well as computer security firms themselves and InfoSec firms, the effect they have on both on coverage and on the law. For instance, the vast majority of statistics about computer crime are taken directly from InfoSec corporations who have a very salient financial motive in making you scared of the internet. They also have a huge part in how these laws are crafted and how these laws are passed. So you're totally right that Congress is in the sway of a lot of lobbying groups and a lot of other powers that be. But I would argue that to argue that they're not affected and that their constituencies aren't affected by media portrayals of hackers that makes it okay for them to pass laws like this, which are essentially, like, actually your point is incredibly well taken, that they're legislating against major threats that they believe exist, which becomes completely ineffective against, like, why won't Bobby stop hacking Wikipedia? It's really irritating.
Yeah.
So
that is, like, a lot of the hacking that people face these days that are actually really problematic isn't the kind of hacking that the government has been actually addressing.
Yeah. Yeah, because, yeah. Yeah, because the government is really focused on SCADA level attacks right now and, like, Stuxnet. It's like, that's where they think the threat is.
And
so.
Unlike the RIAA, not everybody wants to sue
their users. Yeah. Well. Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Do they not exist? This is a really hard question because you're asking me to define an organization as whether or not they were actually breaking the law or not. Did they break the CFAA? Yes. The fact that they are able to swoop down into Ireland and scoop some people up based on charges that have not been proven yet, I find personally disturbing, but that's totally beside the point. Are there people who commit crimes on the internet? Yes. Are there people who dance around in the gray area between crimes and not crimes? Yes. Are there people who just get caught up in computer crime legislation who aren't really committing any crimes? Yes. I'm unwilling at this point in time to definitively state whether or not the members of LawSec are cyber criminals or not. What do you think, Greg?
Honestly, I was in most of those panels. When HPGary got hacked, there were pilots in that IRC channel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they absolutely broke the law.
Yeah.
Whether I agree with the law or not is an entirely different question. But if you agree with it, I mean, yeah, I watched all of that go down. They broke every law they possibly could that night. And it was surprising.
But
I will state one very clear thing, that was... And all of those things, including Stratfor and everything else, were, at this point we now know, under the FBI's watchful.
Yeah, that's also a very interesting point now.
Entrapment is very hard to prove, and less than 1 out of 1,000 entrapment defenses actually are successful. But 2 of the major hacks that happened in the last 6 months were by people who were trained by Sabu, given the target by Sabu, and actually helped by him to do the hack. Seriously, did they break the law or were they entrapped?
That's an extremely valid question right now.
I watched the training. I know exactly what happened.
Another... Yeah. there are people who use the internet for crimes. Like, there are people who use lots of things for crimes.
Some, so I guess when you're trying to figure out, like, how that
No, what I'm saying is that the media metaphor of a hacker doesn't exist, that there's a specific type of character who's been created based on depictions in both in fiction and in news coverage, and that is the character that everybody is reacting to.
So you think that a lot of debates over laws and policy, both, you know, current law and proposed...
are in reaction to a created sociological character who embodies a folk devil persona in our society right now and in relationship to the internet. And that's what people are reacting to. That's what people are legislating against. Not genuine knowledge about the threat space at the time. One thing that is really interesting that sort of has something to do with your question, but I also just want to talk about, is the use of the internet and computers in protests. So, is that a 10-minute signal? Okay, cool. Generally, when you go out on a protest, if you, like, walk out on the street and you want to protest something, you're probably aware that you're going to get arrested. You're probably aware that you're putting yourself out there to be arrested. And if you do get arrested, most likely you're going to get a slap on the wrist, because primarily the arrests in real-world protests are to clear the streets. They're like, we don't want you standing in front of the White House anymore, so we're going to arrest you and give you, like, a disturbing the peace, resisting arrest fake charge, which will get dropped later, but you won't be standing in front of the White House now. When people engage in protest online, because of the way the CFA is written, it doesn't matter why you were doing it, it just matters that you were doing it. So we see cases like the anonymous cases that are going on right now, where you have people who are engaged in protest-oriented DDoSes that they consider to be political speech, being prosecuted as felons, which is not okay. It is not okay to react to political speech as if you are committing a crime, and it is not okay to not have a legal mechanism to differentiate between those types of things. And that is vaguely related to your question, but I also just really wanted to say it. Anybody else have a question? You have a question.
Specific legal question, but okay. I thought since you...
We do have a law student in the back who might actually be able to answer that better than me.
It's a personal opinion because there's no case law behind it, but do you believe the Fifth Amendment, the United States Constitution, can be used as a defense to not compel the releasing of passwords for safe encrypted drives?
Super exciting. I was just talking to someone about this today. That hasn't been sufficiently gone over yet. Do I personally believe, as someone who hasn't gone to law school and is really just going on my knowledge of computer systems, I'm familiar with the law, haven't gone to law school, please don't go out and do something based on this. I'm going to say what I'm going to say, and then you can say what you must say.
It's about self-information. There are cases where they can make you living intelligence with your password, but there are also cases in which they may not be able to do
it. What would be an exception to that rule?
So, like, there was a case where the woman who was accused of mortgage fraud was the big case that happened recently. She said she wasn't going to because it was a violation of her Fifth Amendment rights. The judge said, I don't care. And then she said, I forgot the password. And they said, fine, we'll just decrypt the laptop anyway. So that's an interesting way around it, sort of. I mean, the laptop still gets decrypted. But there has also been a case where a judge said, no, this is a violation of Fifth Amendment rights. It wasn't a circuit court case yet. But we won't have sufficient case law until it gets to an appeals court level or a state Supreme Court level, which will be a while. Actually, there's a case that the ACLU is pushing right now about a high school student who was compelled by her school to divulge her Facebook password. And this is primarily a free speech case that the ACLU is framing it, but it could have implications for what you're talking about. Anyone else? Questions? No?
Okay.
You can go again.
The Computer Fraud Abuse Act makes transmitting basically any kind of malicious information a crime. Right? That was the first section.
Essentially. It's like, so, are these bits bad? Then you're bad.
Do you believe that could be used to prosecute people who were hijacked from botnet programs?
Yes.
Or not, because they don't seem to make them. hesitant to doing that, but they could do that if they really wanted to.
They totally could. I actually remember that one of the things that was specifically told to people who are participating in low-orbit ion cannon DDoS attacks during the WikiLeaks strikes was tell them that you have a botnet, that you have that you've been infected by a botnet and it wasn't you. There are still people in jail for participating in LOIC attacks right now. So I certainly can see people being like, it was a botnet, and the police saying, I don't care. And that also has parallels in other forms of prosecutions where you say, oh no, I was compelled to do this, oh no, I didn't know that it was illegal, blah, 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 and people say, I don't care, you still broke the law. Dharmesh, are you taking a drink of water? Are you raising your hand? Okay, cool. A botnet is a collection of computers that have been infected with a piece of code that puts them under the control of a centralized machine. So, actually, LOIC did have a function called fucking hive mind mode, which is an awesome title, where you could put your control, your computer under the control of someone who was running an IRC server. So you didn't actually have to target the machine yourself. You could just say, go, do what you will with my machine. And so, yeah, you could do that. So I think in terms of protests, it's important to differentiate between forced botnets and voluntary botnets. But that's what a botnet is. Anybody else? Yeah. I hate those books. I really hate those. I watched that movie 3 times for this project.
The
Swedish one. And I cannot bring myself to come into contact with that property ever again. One, I find the sort of commendation of the central characters being like, it's awesome, she's a female hacker, she's so innovative. She's not really a female hacker, she's the complete male stereotype of a hacker, except she's an actress. She's not actually a really well-nuanced female character, she's really just a male hacker with tits. That's also really funny because there was another type of character who's not included in the show that I like to call the fat hacker in the basement, who shows up in a lot of movies. Was in that movie. I think that it wasn't Wasp, it was the other guy. I find them to be incredibly misogynistic and violent, especially violent towards women, and unapologetically so. Instead of being, people were saying like, oh, this confronts the media thing about violence towards women in a really interesting way. I was like, no, it's just really violent towards women, and repeatedly so, and willfully graphically so. So I did not like those movies. I did not like those books. I find her to be an irritating character. I did have an interesting conversation with a film scholar from Old Dominion University who made the point that when you start taking stereotyped characters and turning them into more nuanced characters, especially in terms of how they're portrayed, you do often have characters who are just the stereotype but in a different body. So an example of this is Sidney Poitier. When he started to diversify characters on screen, he had more black characters. Essentially, Sidney Poitier just started out playing white characters and he was black, and it was really exciting. And so in this case, it's like, yeah, she's just a male hacker, but she's a girl. So in that case, yeah, okay, that's kind of interesting, but I don't think it deserves the accolades that it's gotten so far. One more question. Who wants to be the last question? Does that want to be the last question? No? Okay, then that's it.